It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, polar explorer Anne Bancroft tells the tale of a doomed 19th century Arctic expedition and the food that led to its demise. Now, Anne has been to both poles. In fact, she's just back from a little 1,700-mile trek skiing across Antarctica. Our road food duo, the Stearns, bring us anatomically correct chocolate turtles from Gloucester, Mass. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins has some new ideas to sex up your cheese plates. Seattle chef Tom Douglas has the tricks to using that Asian ingredient you bought for one recipe and never used again. And fruit authority David Karp has found the perfect peach. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure. A practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I'd like to talk about cherries. They're beginning to come to market, and from now until late summer, we're going to see several varieties come in and out of season. Each one's going to taste different, so when you've sampled one, you certainly haven't sampled them all. Cherries go so far back historically that I wouldn't be surprised to hear that cavemen ate them. When you're shopping for cherries, here's some things to think about. Look for organic fruit. I prefer it for ecological reasons, but also some organic farmers experiment with old types of fruit, and you can get some interesting flavors. Never buy without tasting first. Check out also how the fruit looks. It should appear shiny, plump, with stems intact. If it's dull, shriveled, or bruised, pass. It's not worth buying. Here's a guide to some of the popular types of cherries you'll see through the summer. There are two basic kinds of cherries, sweet and tart. Now, tart ones can taste really fine. One of the popular varieties is the Morello. Use tart cherries in pies and in jams. With luck, you may find tart cherries freshly pitted at a farm stand or market. Now for some sweet varieties. Bings are lusty and meaty. Lamberts are similar. Royal Annes and Rainiers have a complex sort of sweet tart quality. They always remind me of sweet wine. When you get cherries home, store them in the refrigerator and eat them as soon as you can. Wash just before serving. Now, here's some great ways to eat cherries, other than the best way, which is out of hand. The I Never Cook cherry dessert is made by arranging the best cherries you can find in a shallow dish, stems up. Mix colors if you can. Maybe line the dish with wild grape leaves. Give everyone little bowls of sugar and half-beaten sweet cream, and maybe a glass of sweet dessert wine. Eat with your fingers. Now, purists will just take the cherries straight, but the experimenters in the gang will usually try them several ways. For instance, first dipped in cream and then rolled in sugar. One of my favorite ways to eat cherries is to take a bite into the cherry, then dip it in the wine, so the flesh absorbs the wine. Make your own brandied cherries the way the French do. Take a jar, make sure it's immaculately clean, wash some sweet cherries, leave the stems on, and split a vanilla bean. Pack everything into the jar, then cover it with a decent brandy. Seal, put it in a cool, dark place for 1 to 2 months, then spoon out the cherries and put them over cake or ice cream. Remember the old song, "Can she bake a cherry pie, Billy Boy, Billy Boy?" Well, yes, she can, and yes, you can. Now, please, no canned cherry pie filling at this time of year. I will give in on one thing, though. If making pie crust is not part of your universe, go for store-bought. But to make a fresh cherry filling, try this approach. Toss lots of tart pitted cherries with a little lemon juice, a little bit of almond extract, a pinch of salt to heighten the flavors, and a generous pinch of black pepper to kind of give sparkle to everything. And then add sugar to taste. Finally, here's the big trick. Use Rose Levy Berenbaum's technique for a great pie. This technique eliminates the need for a thickener, and thickeners usually are what dull the flavor of fruit pies. Take the cherries and put them in a strainer. Set the strainer over a bowl. Leave it for about 30 minutes. Finally, boil down the syrup that collects in the bowl until it's thick. Put that back with the cherries. Fill your pie shell. Cover it with a top crust. Bake in a hot oven, about 400 degrees, until the inside is bubbling. And then serve it up. So start enjoying cherries this week and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find the Bialetti Vogue cookware line from Italy, featuring Teflon platinum interiors, polished aluminum bottoms, and stainless steel handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today, polar explorer Anne Bancroft joins us. Anne is just back from her third polar expedition, skiing across Antarctica. She tells us not only of the trials she faced, she has the story of why a lavishly equipped Arctic expedition back in the 19th century succumbed to insanity and starvation for no apparent reason. It's all about the food and the technology. Cheese maven Steve Jenkins says, down with grapes and red delicious apples. If you're going to eat cheese, pair it with some really interesting food. And he's got the goods. You know how you buy an Asian ingredient for a recipe and then it hangs around for a couple of years, like, you know, fish sauce from 1979? Well, Seattle chef Tom Douglas has some new ways to work Asian ingredients into things we eat every day. Fruit Authority David Karp is back. Now, he spent the last five summers hunting down the best peaches and nectarines in California, and he's going to share some of his finds. Then, as we do every week, we'll be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, of all the candies in the world, there's one that Jane and I have a special fondness for, and that is turtles.
You mean the pecan thing with the, there's pecans and there's sticky stuff and there's chocolate, right?
In the average turtle, yes, there are pecans, sticky stuff, also known as caramel, and chocolate. But
yeah,
you know, it
right?
only dawned on us a short while ago that turtles are called turtles because, in fact, made correctly, they resemble a terrapin, a turtle.
I mean, maybe we're really stupid that we never noticed
this. I think so.
I'm not going there.
50-odd years. But the light bulb over the head moment happened recently in Gloucester, Massachusetts, where Michael and I wandered into a wonderful little sort of one-man candy shop called Turtle Alley on Washington Street in Gloucester. And we saw a woman named Hallie Baker making home, you know, handmade turtle candies, and they looked exactly like turtles. Well, I mean, they were not just turtle-esque amoeba-shaped things.
That's it. Jane's got it exactly. The problem with most of your commercial turtles is that the chocolate covers the flippers. Made correctly by hand. Flippers, i.e. the nuts, whether they be the traditional pecans or maybe cashews, which look even more like flippers, stick out of the chocolate and therefore make the candy really resemble a turtle.
I think the thing about Turtle Alley that I just love also is it's the classic turning lemons into lemonade story, because Hallie Baker, who's this really dynamite woman with this, you know, kind of bigger than life personality, told us that, when she was a kid, like all of us, she had a pet turtle. And of course, like all of us, the turtle died. But the pet turtle left such a hole in her heart and such a, you know, a mark on her memory that she decided that when she grew up and became a candy maker, that her specialty would be turtles as an homage to this defunct turtle.
So you have an anatomically correct turtle made by a woman who is trying to recapture that moment in childhood with her first pet.
That's right. And
what is the place? This woman has obviously had a lot of psychotherapy.
Obviously.
Evolved to the point of great self-actualization.
What is the place like, though? I mean, is it a little tiny candy shop, or is it a place where you eat?
It's a classic candy store with all kinds of other candies besides turtles. But I must say that there are so many different kinds of turtles. That's what really won our hearts. You can get turtles made of dark white or milk chocolate. You can have them made with pecans, almonds, peanuts, macadamias, or the best-looking one, the cashew.
Uh-huh. You know, Gloucester, Mass. Is such an interesting town. It's you know, it's classic fishing port. It's where the movie The Perfect Storm was filmed.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, this is kind of the perfect turtle. And there's a lot of very kind of funky down-home places in Gloucester. And Turtle Alley looks like it would be kind of a fancy almost boutique candy shop. And, in fact, all the locals go there for their turtles as well.
Okay,
and so I guess these are fishermen getting turtles, so they should know something about us.
So we have the anatomically correct terrapin edible turtle in many flavors and varieties, and it's Gloucester, Massachusetts. This is great. Hey, thanks, guys.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me, and any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
In addition to spending an inordinate amount of time tracking down chocolate turtles, Gene and Michael Stern are the authors of Square Meals, America's favorite comfort food cookbook. You can hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Want to know about cheese? You talk to Steve Jenkins. Steve spent the better part of 20 years hunting down and selling exceptional cheeses. Now, if you've tuned in before, you know Steve does not hold back on an opinion. Steve, it's good to have you back.
Oh, it's great to hear from you guys, Lynn.
Well, Steve, I want to talk about entertaining with cheese. I mean, it's summer. There's nothing easier than putting out a cheese plate. What I need from you is, what are some ideas for what should go with the cheese?
That's a big thing for me, and I always start with a negative because I'm a negative kind of guy. what I don't like to do when serving cheese or my people to do is to serve boring fruit. There's nothing I'd rather not have with serious cheese than boring fruit.
Like that, boring, I mean, like what?
Like seedless grapes. Red delicious apples, plain old out of season apples, that
mm-hmm,
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not worthy. The cheeses are not worthy of that kind of an accompaniment. In the summertime, we've got such fabulous stone fruit, plums and peaches, marvelous accompaniment to cheeses. Everybody across the country can usually find local stuff that's marvelous to serve with cheeses. Melons in the summertime. Melons and cheeses go beautifully together. So if it's going to be fruit, I want it to be seasonal. I want it to be so local and so perfect that the leaves are still attached and the fruit's literally dripping with sweetness. That's the kind of fruit you've got to strive to serve with cheese.
What about dried fruit? Is there anything you like to pair specifically with dried fruit?
Well, I serve dried fruit more frequently with cheese than anything else. I'm crazy for it. But specifically, we like Royal Medjool dates, those great, big, huge California dates, the greatest date in the world, that have this inner luminescence and this incredible sweetness that marries so beautifully with big, big, huge flavored cheeses. Great prune is fabulous with cheese. And think in terms of anything that you can find in your market that's a particularly good dried fruit. Figs are great. Dried cantaloupe is marvelous.
Okay.
All kinds of stuff. Dried papaya. It's so pretty on the plate, but it tastes so good and has such good toothsomeness to it.
What about the savory side of things?
Well, the savories, I'm sort of doctrinaire. I always serve my savory accompaniments with sheep's and goat's milk cheeses rather than cow's milk cheeses. I just think they marry much better. Olives in particular go so much better with sheep and goat cheeses than with cow's milk mm-hmm. cheeses. And it makes sense because olives come from areas all around the Mediterranean basin where goats and sheep reign, as opposed to cattle. Cattle are not in these areas, so it makes sense that a savory thing like a dressed olive that you've washed off and added some chopped up lemon peel, perhaps some smashed cloves of garlic, or maybe a dried herb, and always with extra virgin olive oil. Olives are the perfect accompaniment to sheep's and goat's milk cheeses.
Anything else that comes to mind?
Roasted tomatoes. I loathe sun-dried tomatoes. I absolutely can't stand them. But a roasted tomato is a wonderful thing. You can make them yourself with either plum tomatoes or grape tomatoes or cherry tomatoes that you find in the marketplace just by cutting them in half and squeezing out some of the liquid and putting them on a cookie sheet and drying them out in the oven. Marvelous thing to serve with cheeses. Nuts. Serve hazelnuts and almonds and walnuts that you've put in the oven on a cookie sheet and heated up, so you're serving warm nuts, which absolutely burst with flavor when they're served warm. Fabulous accompaniment to all kinds of cheeses.
You know, the other thing when you said about sheep cheeses, it occurred to me, olive oil. Olive oil. They do that all the time in the Mediterranean, don't they?
Absolutely. And Lynn, you know how wonderful Italian honey is. It's got that great adult bitterness to it that makes it very, very different from the American honey that we all know so well. European honey, specifically Spanish or Italian honey, is a wonderful thing to drizzle onto sheep's cheeses and goat's cheeses, and then a few twists from the pepper mill. Wonderful way to accompany a fresh cheese.
Oh, yeah.
And the fruit pastes that we're finding, specifically the quince paste that we get out of Catalonia, they call it membrillo. It's this gorgeous orange sort of adult chuckle that you slice thin and serve with the great cheeses from Spain, and it's so intensely sweet it makes your teeth hurt. But with cheeses, it's a marvelous accompaniment, and you'll begin to see these around markets all over the place.
So, Steve, any rules here for pairing the fruit or these other things with the cheese?
Lynn, the rule is there are no rules. Be bold. Don't worry about the power of a specific cheese going with the power of an accompaniment. Make the colors beautiful, be eclectic, throw stuff at the cheese, all of the things that we've mentioned.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Pleasure.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. You can find Steve behind the cheese counters at Fairway Markets in New York City. You can find his picks for cheese accompaniments on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, polar explorer Anne Bancroft with a 150-year-old mystery, easy ways with Asian ingredients, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Polar explorers Anne Bancroft and Leif Arneson recently skied 1,700 miles across the continent of Antarctica. They were the first women to do this. Now, just imagine what this was like. You're on skis, you're pulling a 250-pound sled of food and equipment, it's 30 below zero, the wind's blowing at 100 miles an hour, and you're hacking your way over mountains and crevices. Oh, and one more thing. If you don't reach your destination by a certain date, you could be trapped. Well, a couple of months ago, we talked with Anne and Leif from their tent midway through their trek. Now they're back, and Anne Bancroft has joined me in the studio. Anne, it is really good to have you back.
It's good to be here.
And when we spoke to you, you were in your tent 80 miles from the pole, and you had just run out of essentially the savory foods that you folks had counted on having to get you all the way to the South Pole before you were resupplied, right?
That's right. We were we had planned for 50 days. And when we talked with you, I think we were around our 58th day, and we would not make the pole until 64 days out. So you can see where the food would start to run pretty shy at that point. We had actually 50 days of breakfast, but they were too beefy. We were eating an oatmeal, an instant oatmeal, but we had beefed it up with wonderful dried nuts and dried fruit. And then the gross part is the oil, just a tablespoon of oil in each serving of oatmeal. And that was so rich that we were actually splitting our oatmeals. And so then we had this leftover.
But you had to have those foods. I mean, this is called survival.
Exactly. I mean, there's two ingredients that make the calories that we were needing so critical. And that was the cold that we're living in. And it's not just the cold during the day. We're also in it. You know, when we were talking with you, for instance, it's probably about 30 below zero outside, maybe 35 below outside. That means it's probably 20, 25 below inside the tent. In fact, we were sitting in our sleeping bags chatting with you with our parkas on. So it's chilly and you're burning calories just sitting. And then you have the hard work that we're doing. So those two ingredients are the element that allows for you to burn 5,000 calories every day very, very efficiently. And, of course, you can eat all this fat as well.
Yeah, well, from where I'm sitting right now, literally, that sounds great. But I'd like to get into the history of polar exploration because, obviously, food was key.
Yeah.
What were some of the key moments in terms of expeditions preparing to feed themselves in polar exploration?
Well, I think throughout time, when you start reading the accounts and reading them very closely, as Leif and I do all the time, you see that there's a lot of attention paid to the diet, the different kinds of things that they're hoping for, whether or not they're going to be getting some of their supplies from the land. An example would be seal or penguin meat. You know, and what kinds of calories are they seeking out? And the elements that the leaders typically talk about is not only the calories, but also the morale that's tied in with food. And of course, we talk about that here in this environment too, that sitting down, you know, to dinner with friends is really about the social interaction, as much as it is about the food and sustaining us as human beings. So, morale is really important in terms of these expeditions as well. If the morale starts to break down, doesn't matter how many calories you have.
The quality and the variety probably was really key.
Yep, and the kinds of calories that will sustain you in this environment.
There was one expedition I read about very briefly that took place in the middle part of the 1800s. It was Sir John Franklin. He was British.
Yeah.
And they were looking for a Northwest Passage. This is now Arctic. This is the North Pole. And there was nobody could figure out why they didn't make it.
Yeah.
Tell us that story.
Well, in brief, I mean, it's a fabulous story, and there's several books that have been written about it, and even a film that's been created. But some of the men went, in many people's words, berserk. And so in recent times, an expedition was launched to try and uncover perhaps why that took place, why not only did they not reach their goal, but more importantly, what could they uncover as to the reasons for some of the actions that were documented about this expedition? And what they discovered was that the vendor that they chose to seal their food or their provisions had used lead as a way to seal up the can. And the cans, not only, obviously, lead was not a good ingredient, but was not really known at that time, but it wasn't done well as well, and so that there was perhaps some bacteria leaking over the course of time, et cetera. And so that's what they start to surmise by exhuming the bodies of some of the graves and discovering that this is why they might
have... Lead poisoning.
Lead poisoning. Why they had this kind of behavior.
And if I remember correctly, lead poisoning is about your central nervous system, so your judgment is affected.
Mm-hmm.
Your appetite is affected, so you don't want to eat anymore.
Yeah, you don't know that you're starving.
And it's all because of the cans.
Yeah.
And it was new technology then, right?
It was new. It was brand new technology.
So they thought they had the very latest thing.
Yeah.
All that because of a can.
Well, you know, and then the thing that's so exciting about that from my perspective is that so little has changed. We're, you know, we go out on these expeditions and we're looking for the latest and the greatest in terms of our gear and our food and what we're going to pack our food and provisions in. So we're constantly trying to push that envelope as well. So you're exploring on many frontiers, and there's always risk involved when you're doing that.
What hasn't worked for you? Because you've done the North Pole and you've done the South Pole twice now.
Well, what I've come to learn, you know, from doing the North Pole in 1986 to now, is that in food, in particular, with the provisions and the menu, is not only getting the right calories. And we talk a lot to nutritionalists and dietitians as they learn, you know, the best way to get the most performance out of us as we're working under these kinds of conditions. But also, really, I think what I look for as a leader of these last two expeditions, you know, as we're putting these projects together, is how, you know, is the morale factor, I guess I would call it, and how can we create a food that is simple, because you don't have a lot of time or energy to prepare in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to, you know, boil water and stir. But how do you find the right kinds of foods that taste good? Because you do need a high level of fat. We were eating 45% fat in our 5,000 calorie diet per day. That's a lot. And oftentimes that's a drudgery to try and stuff down you, because it's you know, it's fatty. So
yeah,
how do you find it in ways that are palatable so that you can enjoy your time in the tent, which is a very important time? We only have two times when we have a hot meal, morning and night. And particularly when there's a group of just two, that's an important social time for us to be talking about anything from our fears and our successes that are unraveling on the trip, but also, you know, our hopes and dreams for the future and our family and friends that we've left behind. That's our social time that is so important to sort of nurture that emotional piece. And you do that typically around a meal.
This is so interesting to me that this, I mean, it's obvious on one level, but we think you must be concerned primarily with the raw survival, but that as human beings, we still need that pleasure.
Oh, absolutely.
It makes such a difference. Anne Bancroft, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me again.
Polar explorer Anne Bancroft and her colleague Liv Arneson are the first women to ski across the continent of Antarctica. You can get information on their expedition and their future plans on our website, splendidtable.org.
Tom Douglas is a chef in Seattle, and he revels in it. Tom's food is all about the ethnic mix of the city. So it's no surprise that Asian flavors dominate a lot of his dishes. He's got several restaurants, and he's author of the award-winning Tom Douglas's Seattle Kitchen. Tom, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Nice to hear you.
Tom, you use Asian ingredients constantly, and I'd like to take a look at three ingredients that I think a lot of us may have hanging out in the kitchen. Vietnamese fish sauce, Chinese hoisin sauce, and Japanese miso. Okay?
You're right. I use them a lot.
Exactly. Well, let's start with the fish sauce.
Okay. Well, you know, what a stinky thing that is.
Well, yeah, old socks come to mind on this one.
I know.
Yeah.
Most people, you take the lid off of that and you think, oh, my God, what I bought is bad. The store sold me some bad stuff. But it really is one of the most beautiful, fragrant ingredients. And it really, when you use it in combination with other things, it becomes very flowery and it adds a depth and a base to your sauce that you wouldn't get any other way. It's hard to add dirty socks to a sauce and think it's going to come out good.
Yeah, I know. But what's the key here? I mean, how can I put it into just an everyday dish?
In everyday dish, I either sprinkle it on vegetables, just along with some dill, you know, on cabbage or carrots, or I most love it in a caramel sauce. And I think that's the one I would tell you to try.
A caramel sauce?
A caramel sauce. Yeah, you don't think about it that way. But I brown sugar in a pan. And then once it gets to that golden brown color, I add maybe I add the fish sauce and some ground ginger. And then I add a little water just to make it liquid enough to spread around. And I use that as a marinade, say on a game hen or on just a chicken or even on a pork skewers or something like that. Marinate that for a while. And so when you grill it again, that sugar caramelizes right on your chicken or your pork, and the fish sauce just adds this incredible depth of flavor.
That is killer.
You can use it on anything, shrimp, scallops, you name it. But that caramel sauce is where I end up using fish sauce the most.
Now, wait a minute. Where should I store the fish sauce?
Well, first buy a small container. I mean, I think that's a real key with any of these ingredients that, you know, me, I use enough of it to buy the big one, but for a lot of people, they're buying it for one recipe, so you buy it in the smallest size because, mm-hmm. like anything else, once you open it, it starts to go bad. And even if you keep it in the fridge, it loses its essence, so to speak, its fragrance, as quick as, you know, you wouldn't keep a carton of milk in the fridge more than a month. You know, why should you keep your fish sauce? I think buy small and try and use it up in the next couple of weeks on different recipes.
Okay, look, I'm blown away with this idea for the fish sauce. Let's go to miso.
Okay. Well, there's many different varieties. There's the dark goldens and reds, and I tend to just use the white or a light brown miso. Mm-hmm. I use it in many ways, but I think the simplest thing and one of the more healthy things outside of miso soup, I tend to use it in vinaigrettes. For example, my daughter loves, it's hard to get her to eat lots of big salads, but she loves crunchy lettuce, like just a plain head of iceberg. And so instead of making, say, a blue cheese dressing, mm-hmm. heavy in fat and all that kind of stuff, I make a simple miso dressing. It really, it broadens the flavor base of, say, your rice vinegar and mm-hmm. your peanut oil. And it's fermented, so it has a quality kind of... it's a little grainy. It's kind of like mustard in a way, but a lighter flavor. It's a very refreshing.
What kind of proportions are we talking here?
Well, let's say for a half a cup of oil and a quarter cup of rice vinegar, you're looking at maybe a tablespoon to two of miso. So it's not a huge amount. And again, you can buy those in 3-ounce containers up to 1-pound containers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and that can go on any salad?
Any salad, any fish, you know, a piece of grilled salmon with a miso vinaigrette on top of some soybeans or something sounds really delicious.
Okay, let's go to hoisin sauce.
My favorite. I had it this morning. I did. I had it this morning with side pork for breakfast.
For breakfast.
For breakfast.
I like the way you eat. Okay. All right.
Well, anyway, it's my favorite. I have a great recipe for a hoisin barbecue sauce in my book, and it's just mixed regular hoisin, which I like Kunshan brand. It's one of the biggest factories in China, but it's also one of the best. And you don't just use hoisin straight. Generally, you mix it. I mix it with orange peel, star anise, maybe a little sesame oil, a little rice vinegar.
Yeah.
And I make a barbecue sauce, and I make either short ribs or pork ribs right on the charcoal grill and glaze it off with this hoisin barbecue, or it's really delicious just on a grilled tortilla. Almost, you know, I kind of cheat. I make green onion pancakes with tortillas instead of the whole process.
Right,
and
right.
I use those with my hoisin barbecue sauce pork ribs, and it's really a delicious combination.
I'll bet that's great just brushed on eggplant and grilled.
Absolutely.
Boy.
Absolutely. But okay. You got to remember, it's very sweet. So anytime you're going to grill something, you cook it, and then you brush it and caramelize it at the last minute.
Yeah, because otherwise it'll burn.
It'll burn. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Thank you. We now know we have some great ideas. I'm still blown away by the fish sauce and the caramel. This is dynamite.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Tom Douglas is chef owner of Etta's in Seattle, and he's author of the award-winning Tom Douglas's Seattle Kitchen, a food lover's cookbook and guide. You can get Tom's recipe for hoisin barbecue sauce and miso vinaigrette by going to our website. That's splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Wayne on the line. Hi, Wayne. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. My fellow employees and I got into a little argument about two things.
Yeah?
Does spicy necessarily mean it's hot? And what is the difference between spices and seasonings?
Interesting. May I ask, what do you guys do that you have time to talk about these things?
We're in the middle of a break, and we were eating something from a table of food,
uh-huh.
And it was hot. Somebody said, that's spicy, and I said, what do you mean it's spicy? And well, we work on a television show.
Oh, which show?
Nikki, for Warner Brothers.
Ah, okay.
Sunday nights at 9 o'clock.
That's your plug. Okay, you're in the business. I get it.
Had to get it in.
Okay, spicy does, from a lot of people, mean hot. But the reality is, just as you kind of said, what does it mean? The reality is it means something with a lot of flavor in it, something with a lot of spices in it. So it could be cinnamon, allspice, nutmeg, whatever, not hot.
No.
But just a lot of different tastes in it.
Yeah, I thought, because I said mulled cider is spicy, it's not hot.
Yeah, that's right.
It's spicy.
Yeah, Indian food is spicy, but not necessarily hot.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing is the difference between spices and seasonings. Well, you could say spice is a seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me? Seasoning, a generic description of anything that might bring flavor, any incidental ingredient that might bring flavor to a dish.
Uh-huh. Well,
something you add a small, relatively small amount of.
I see.
So you could even say a splash of wine is a seasoning
uh-huh.
in a dish. You could say, you know, the difference between a seasoning and an ingredient. An ingredient is there's a larger quantity of it.
I see.
But there is another difference. There's a difference between spices and herbs.
Right. Now, I understand that.
Yeah, okay, because one's the seeds or the berries and the other one's the leaf, usually.
But herbs could be seasonings, too, then.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Seasonings is that overall umbrella, anything that brings flavor to the dish, at least this is my definition, that is not a major ingredient
right.
in the dish.
Even salt.
Salt is definitely a seasoning. Yeah, that's right. So now I know what you guys ponder while you're doing television. This is good to know. This is very good to know. I mean, we ponder this stuff all the time, but we do a food show.
Right.
So hey, do you guys cook?
Oh, some of us do, and I think those of us that were arguing about it were the cooks.
Uh-huh. Nobody else really cares.
No.
Yeah, that's the other side of all of this. Hey, thanks a lot, Wayne.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy.
All right.
Well, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Now it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's today's trivia question. What popular condiment was first advertised as, and I quote, blessed relief for mother and other women in the household? We're going to have that answer in a moment and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vakely Productions and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We've got open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. That number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, what popular condiment was first advertised as, quote, blessed relief for mother and other women of the household? It's ketchup. Now, you all know this. We Americans put it on everything that doesn't move too fast. And the other thing is, we're supposed to scorn it. But ketchup tastes good. I mean, look, it's sweet, it's a little tart, it's tomatoes. Basically, what is not to like here? Now, ketchup was always homemade, up until H.J. Heinz got a hold of it. Now, and it was a pain to make. You had to peel tons of tomatoes, cook everything down, bottle it, sterilize it. So when Heinz decided to bottle ketchup back in 1876, he came up with this advertising slogan. His ads described it as blessed relief for mother and other women in the household. I mean, he knew where to hit where it counted. Now, ketchup's got ancestry. I mean, we got it from England, where they used to eat much more mushroom ketchup than tomato ketchup. But trust me, the taste-shy British did not invent the idea of ketchup. Its great-granddaddy came from the Orient, probably from China, with not a tomato in it. Okay, let's get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We've got Ginger on the line. Hey, Ginger?
Yeah.
What do you want to talk about?
My husband went to France recently, and he brought back olive oil, herbs, olives, Dijon mustard. But what I am puzzled by is a can of sweetened chestnut puree.
Mm-hmm.
And olive paste. We have plain olive paste with anchovies, and olive paste with capers.
Well, I've got two initial reactions here. A, what a generous traveler he is. B, why in heaven's name did he take you with him?
It was a military trip.
Well, okay. All right. Okay. He is generous. He is generous. So you're trying to figure out, what do you do with sweetened chestnut puree?
Yeah.
All right. And what do you do with all these olive pastes?
Correct.
Okay. He's got good taste. Okay. The sweetened chestnut puree, you can do a lot of stuff with. You can use it as a cake filling. You know, instead of frosting in the middle of a cake and then frost the cake with some whipped cream. You can work it in and make ice cream with it, add cream to it, you know, and put it in an ice cream machine. It's dynamite. The other thing you can do is, one of the things the French do is that they whip cream with a lot of vanilla and a little sugar, and then they work it into the chestnut puree until they end up with like a mousse.
Oh,
it is to die for. And then you put shaved chocolate on it, or you serve it with a hot chocolate sauce.
Okay.
This is a good thing. Now, when it comes to the olive paste, what these are cured olives, usually from the south of France, and they've usually got in things in them like garlic and capers, and sometimes you taste anchovies and that kind of thing. Taste them. They can be very salty. But one of the things that's done with them is they're mixed with olive oil and fresh herbs, and you spread them on toast.
Okay.
Or you can use them take a chicken breast, a boneless chicken breast, make a little slit in it, and stuff some of them inside of that slit, and then grill the chicken breast.
All right.
Yeah, you can put it on top of grilled foods. That's another thing. And the other thing people do with them is they toss them with fresh raw tomatoes and pasta.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I knew I'd get you on that one.
Well, we've tried it on dried toast.
And what did you think?
Well, it's good. You have to acquire a taste for it.
It's very salty, isn't it?
Yes, and it's very heavy.
Yeah. Now,
flavor.
What they often do in France is they cut that with something like chopped tomatoes, chopped fresh herbs, diced onion. I've even had them mixed with soft butter,
okay.
which again, you know, cuts some of the intensity because they're really intense.
They are. And the perfect thing with it was red wine.
Yes,
which
exactly.
Which you did bring from France.
There's one other trick, you know. I've seen people put a teaspoon or so of these olive paste into a tomato sauce.
Okay.
You know, just as a flavoring.
All right.
So, you know, keep them in the fridge. You can do a lot of stuff with them.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. And we got an email. A while back, we had a caller who had gotten a hold of some macadamia nuts in the shell. And the big problem was they couldn't get through the shell. And I had said I didn't have a clue of what to do, but we speculated together. Well, we got an email. This always happens. You guys are the experts. And we got one from Tim, who is in San Diego, who buys fresh macadamia nuts. And this is what he says. A, don't roast them. B, you can actually get a macadamia nut cracker. And because I had said, worst comes to worst, use a hammer. Not a good idea. So if you have macadamia nuts and you want to go out there and open them up, look for a macadamia nut cracker. It evidently has a blade-like device that just cuts right through the shell. We've got Chris, who has been extremely patient. So, Chris, what do you want to talk about?
I'd like to talk about chocolate and hot pepper.
Mmm. You've been to Mexico, I gather.
No, I watched the movie Chocolat.
Oh, yeah. Did you believe that? I mean, you watch that stirring chocolate, and you're ready to leap out of your seat into the screen.
Oh, it was incredible.
Yeah, it really was.
I dutifully went home to the internet and tried to find some recipes to make for my wife, and I found nothing.
Huh.
I found a good mole sauce recipe, but it was incidental.
Are you trying to seduce your wife, just like they did in the movie?
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, you know, we're getting these great men calling in. All right, so you want to find a way. Do you want a sweet, like hot chocolate with chili in it?
Well, that would be nice also. I was also thinking a sauce for either a white fish or a chicken breast.
A savory sauce. I must say, mole does come to mind. But I wonder, I've never done this. I'm just going to think of, you know, let's work it out loud. Mole, as you know, is a combination of chilies and other ingredients and then chocolate.
Yeah, but very little chocolate.
Yeah, very little chocolate. And you want more chocolate, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking chocolate-covered chicken breast, but that just seems a little odd to me.
It does seem odd, but I'm not. Let's not discard it out of hand here. I mean, it may be a very interesting idea. If you could do bittersweet chocolate and balance it with something that's a little acidic, I don't know if this would work or not. I wonder what would happen if you reduced some port wine and added that, reduced it until it was syrupy,
mm-hmm.
worked into that a small amount of really high-quality bittersweet chocolate, like Valrhona does what they call their 71% chocolate.
What kind of proportions are you talking?
Well, I'm saying if you boil down a cup and a 2 cups of port wine to a quarter cup,
mm-hmm.
or until it's almost syrupy, and then work into that about an ounce of melted chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd use ground ancho chili, which I use in sweet chocolate dishes because it's very velvety and it has just a little tingle to it.
Okay.
And I'd add some orange zest, which is my very favorite combination. You do ancho chili, orange zest, and chocolate, and you are in seventh heaven.
Okay, I will try it.
And you could even throw in a little bit of cinnamon. Because all of that, by the way, is very traditionally Mexican. And a lot of what was going on in Chocolat, especially in that hot chocolate, was about that.
Great.
See what you think of it.
I will try it, and I'll call you back.
Yeah, let me know. But the other thing is you could make her wonderful hot chocolate using half and half and ancho chili and black pepper and ground almonds. And she will be yours, along with anybody else who tastes it. So be careful where you, who you serve it to.
All right, I will.
Hey, though, thanks for a great question.
Thank you.
I think it's a great idea.
Okay.
Give it a shot.
I will.
All right.
Thank you.
Speaking of exotic ideas, I had the tough job of spending 5 days in Honolulu doing some programs for Hawaii Public Radio. And aside from being totally captivated by this town and eating some fabulous food, I have finally learned what sushi quality fish means. Let me explain. I was taken to a fish auction. Now, evidently, there were only 4 fish auctions in the entire United States, and 2 are on Hawaii. I was taken there by a local chef named George Mavro. And you go there at dawn, and the sushi quality designation always applies, evidently, to fresh tuna. And what happens is the fish come into this auction, and they're auctioned off. And this is what, it's amazing. At 5 o'clock in the morning, a whole tuna may be sold for $10,000. By 2 o'clock the same afternoon, that tuna will be on the market in Tokyo for $25,000. But as I was looking at all these tunas, I noticed that every one of them had this wedge taken out of them right at the tail, so you could see the red meat. And the people who were buying at the auction were going up and down the rows, reaching down and reaching into those cuts and kind of taking some of the meat and rubbing it between their fingers. Well, Chef Mavro showed me exactly what they were looking for. We dug into a tuna, and he said, let me show you this. He said, high quality, sushi quality is the highest quality you can get for tuna. And what it was about was the conformation of the meat. It's like a prime age steak. The meat couldn't be mushy. It couldn't be too moist. It had to have fat and lean, but it also had to have a real firmness to the meat. So what one of the things they were looking for was how mushy, how soft the meat was. They wanted something that had firmness and structure. So that's what sushi quality is about. And by the way, I'm going to put up on our website in another couple of days some of the great restaurants I visited in Honolulu. So that's what sushi is all about. You know, in my lexicon, there is one reason why summer happens, and that is to bring us great tasting peaches and nectarines. Now, if you're only finding barely passable fruit in the market, there's somebody you've got to meet. He's one of the country's authorities on fruit. His name is David Karp. David writes for the LA Times, and he is obsessed with finding the best tasting fruit. He has spent the last 5 summers searching California for the very best varieties of peaches and nectarines. Well, we've got David on the phone. David, it is good to talk to you again.
Well, good to be with you, Lynn.
Okay, so after 5 years, I know your list is about 10 growers, but after these 5 years, could you pick maybe 3 of them that you could tell us about?
People ask me that all the time, and it's so difficult because I love so many of them so much. But I think first of the Snow Queen, because it's the first really good stone fruit of peach or nectarine of the season, comes in the Central Valley in about the second week of June. The Snow Queen is a white nectarine that was developed about 50 years ago by Armstrong Nurseries. And I guess somebody thought that it would be commercial, but it sure wasn't because it just brews so easily. It wasn't productive. They just don't ship well, or they don't have the appearance that's demanded by the market. But the Snow Queen white nectarine has, in addition to really intense, complex, lingering flavor, it's juicy but has really dense flesh that's very different from that of commercial peaches and nectarines. And probably my best recommendation would be for mail order, if you don't happen to be in California, would be Ron Mansfield of Gold Bud, who grows up in the mountains, the Sierra foothills.
Well,
he does sell it in early July, and the times are really important, by mail order.
Okay, so Ron Mansfield, mail order. We'll put this stuff up on the web. That's a white nectarine. What about a great peach?
Well, for a white peach, And I'm sort of keen on what, well, I like both white and yellow, but the whites, the really classic whites are rarer even than the yellows,
mm-hmm.
I guess because they're more delicate. If I had to choose one, boy, that's so difficult. The Silver Logan is a giant, really luscious peach, but again, probably, they may kill me because they don't have very much production. Probably the best way to get it, if you don't live in California, is from Frog Hollow, east of San Francisco in Contra Costa County and Brentwood. And you might be able to talk them into mail ordering you a box or two. They also grow a lot of other really good varieties of fruit, too.
All right, we'll beg them. Do you have a third?
Yes, the Baby Crawford, and that's so special. It's probably my favorite of all of these. It's related to the Great Crawford peaches, which were considered the finest of all peaches in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And they're basically extinct right now. Nobody has them. However, my friend Annie Mariani of Morgan Hill, which is south of San Jose, somehow came across something. Actually, it was an experimental peach at UC Davis that was discarded onto the discard pile. He inherited it and took it over and started growing it, and it provides much of the intense peachy flavor. I mean, I just had a regular commercial peach for breakfast this morning, and I thought, oh, gee, this is pretty good, but it's nothing like a Baby Crawford. They're small. They're pale in color. They're basically just golden yellow on the outside. I think that they're gorgeous. You actually have to go to Andy Mariani's, but it's worth the pilgrimage. He's got dozens of other really good varieties, and if you go there in August, you're sure to get something really special.
Okay, now, for those of us who aren't lucky enough to get our hands on this fruit, any tips for how to find good fruit, how to select good fruit in the market?
Gosh, I guess it would just be the aroma, and don't be a sucker for high red blush, because that actually is associated with less than stellar flavor. I would look for something actually that's ugly but charismatic, and you know, just buy one and take a taste, and if it's good, buy more, and if not, forget about it. And then there are sugar spots. They look like freckling on the fruit, and it's regarded as a commercial flaw by shippers. I don't know who decided that, but as it was recently verified in a scientific study, where the fruit is freckled, it tends to be sweetest underneath.
Okay, we've got lusty peaches and nectarines and sugar spots. Hey, David, thank you.
Thanks so much, Clint.
David Karp writes for the Los Angeles Times. Now, you can find his fruit picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, everybody, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this bit of wisdom. A closed mouth gathers no feet. Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, offering Cascade stoneware made by Anchor Hocking. This Portuguese stoneware, designed to be rugged, features an unglazed bottom for even cooking and can be used in the microwave, oven, or on the table. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music was composed by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.